You're listening to the Taylor Swift Fan Club podcast, the podcast about all the things that matter and some of the things that don't.
And you're here with Michael Pattinson and
Tim Burton.
Hello. So I just want to start out with a little bit about ourselves, so I'll go first. So my name's Michael Pattinson. I'm a cyclocrosser, a road rider, and a keen Zwifter. Guess I've been on Zwift for about 5 years now, done about 40,000 kilometres. Tim and I both ride for Club 3R, which we'll talk about a bit later. And also, kind of, I've got a technology job and an interest in all things philosophical and economics, and I'm sure we'll get into that as well. Tim?
So I think I've been on Zwift for a similar amount of time. I think I started around about 2016, 2017. I don't know how many kilometres I've done online. When I'm not Zwifting, I like to ride outdoors on the road. I've just got into time trialling in the last 6 months. My background is that I was a school teacher for years and years and years, a secondary school teacher teaching religious studies and philosophy, which I still do a little bit, but we'll get more into that at some point, I'm sure.
What attracted you to Zwift?
Well, I remember actually when I first started cycling, because I haven't been cycling that long. I've actually been Zwifting almost as long as I've been cycling.
I got into
cycling and loved it. Realised perhaps in the summer that I was doing my first kind of proper season of cycling that I wasn't going to be able to carry on doing it regularly in the winter. And I was like, oh no, I really want to carry on doing this. So I thought, well, I'll get a turbo trainer. I thought, well, that sounds really boring, but it's better than nothing. And I remember having a conversation with some colleagues, and I remember saying, wouldn't it be cool if you could have a turbo trainer that, as you cycled along, it made you cycle along in virtual reality, and you could have it so that it got harder when you got to a hill or something like that. And so they said, yeah, that exists already. You didn't invent that. And so I went and bought a Tax Vortex and signed up to Zwift. And the rest is history, really. What about you?
Mine was sort of similar with a short run into it. I'm one of the people who got inspired by the Olympics in 2012, because Vicky and I went to watch the Olympics, and we watched some cycling in the Olympic Park in between things, and I was sort of sat watching it a bit fat and a bit very unfit, and I just thought, that looks quite good fun. So I got really into it and started racing and things like that. But then when William came along, William's five, I got quite, I don't know if depressed is the right word, but just, you know, just couldn't find a way of fitting any cycling in. So very similar to your conversation, I had a conversation with one of my teammates going, what am I going to do? And he said, have you heard of Zwift? So I got on Zwift, and because I already had a power meter and a dumb trainer from all my training, got straight into it that way. And also that's how I stumbled across 3R, because the only ride that really fitted in with my schedule was the then called Igniter at 5:45 in the morning, which was before the family woke up. And the rest is history. So, you know, 807 races later and 41,000 kilometres, here we are.
Yeah. I mean, likewise with finding 3R, and again, we'll talk about 3R in a minute, I expect, exactly the same for me, that I wanted to fit in some training before I went to work, and saw that there was this thing called Vault that happened at 6:15, I think once or twice a week, maybe.
Yeah, originally it was, yeah.
45 minutes, an average of 2.5 watts per kilo. And so I thought, oh, that sounds good. And so I'd get on there, and we would do like a few laps of Watopia Flats, because that was basically all there was at the time. And yeah, brilliant. So before you got into cycling, what kind did you do? You said that you were unfit and overweight. Did you do any kind of exercise?
No, when I was younger, I used to mountain bike and stuff, you know, bikes for transport when we were younger, I suppose. I used to do that, but I never really did anything And it's funny because I sort of think that I'm quite lucky that I didn't, because I'm anatomically kind of designed for endurance sports and I'm a much better runner than I am cyclist.
Okay.
And I probably would have got into it and been an unhappy amateur, if you know what I mean. Sure. Whereas now I'm a happy amateur.
Yeah.
But yeah, never really done anything.
Because I was similar in that I had a bit of a wake-up call, I suppose, in my mid-30s. I had to kind of take myself in hand because I realised that I was more overweight than I had ever been. I basically did no exercise. I would occasionally go for long walks with my dog over the moors,
yeah.
And you know, enjoyed doing that sort of thing. But I didn't do any kind of regular exercise. And of course, I got away with that in my 20s.
Mm.
But then in my 30s, you know, you just gradually put on weight. And we went on holiday to Germany and I ate loads of Wurst and Schwarzwälder Kirschtorte and yeah. Came home and got on the scales. And I think it was when I realised that according to my BMI, BMI is a bit of a blunt instrument, but according to my BMI, I was technically obese. And I thought, this is no good. I was having like weird pains in my chest. I'd have heartburn all the time from the rubbish food that I was eating. And I was just exhausted all the time.
Yeah.
I was just always really tired. I was too tired to do my job. So I was a full-time teacher at the time. I would come home from school and I would fall asleep on the sofa early evening. Wouldn't have time to do all the work that I needed to do. And was just knackered. And I realised that all the people that I knew who had loads of energy were the people who did loads of exercise. And
yeah.
So I thought, right, there's something to this, isn't there? So I had a go at running. So this is quite a long story, this. I had a go at running. Didn't really like it very much. Hurt my knee. So quickly gave up on that, but got my dad's old bike out of the garage that he'd given me. And didn't look back, really. It was that was it. Just loved it.
And this is kind of what I think what inspired us talking about this podcast, really, because there is something special about bikes and yeah. fitness in general, but there's also something special about that digital community that's been created on Zwift. Because I can't think of an example where we would have met. Just can't think of it.
No.
We live in different places. We have completely different backgrounds. It would never have crossed. And yet, that's what's brilliant for me about Zwift and about 3R. It's this massive community of other, sounds a bit odd, other internet friends.
Yeah, it is extraordinary, isn't it? And it's something which I'm sure will just become more normal, and it's becoming more normal that people form community online, and that yeah. that is genuinely community, and people are genuinely friends. But it's. It is an amazing thing, and it's hard to explain to people who don't really understand what Zwift is, what online cycling yeah. is. It's hard to explain to them that I get up most mornings and go for a bike ride online with people, most of whom I've never met before, but an awful lot of whom I would consider friends.
Yeah.
And again, we'll talk about this later, but... you know, a couple of days ago, I was doing my Everesting challenge on Zwift, and the support from the Team 3R was just unbelievable. And I think people who were watching my live stream when I did that would have realised that something really special was going on here in yeah. terms of that community.
Yeah, and I think that links to kind of, I think, why I wanted to do this podcast, really, which is, and also why we called it, I think, the Taylor Zwift Fan Club, is it's about Zwift, but it's sort of not about Zwift at all. It's about the joy of being part of that community and how, yeah. as you say, how that kind of the promise of the internet can be spread out into the world of work and the world of relationships and the world generally. It's exciting times, I think.
Yeah. So one of the things that we have enjoyed doing, you've been doing this a lot longer than I have, but one of the favourite regular rides on Zwift is 3R Mountain Madness on a Saturday morning.
Yeah.
Tell people who are listening a bit more about that.
I started doing Mountain Madness because I wanted a Tron bike. So, and it was the ride that I worked out gave me the most elevation.
And if anyone doesn't, if anyone doesn't know what the Tron bike is,
it's basically this bike that doesn't really look like a bike. It's all kind of shiny and glowy. And you have to ride a certain amount of elevation on Zwift to gain it. And I used to see loads of people riding it and thinking, oh, I want that. So it was one of the challenges. It's one of the things that's good about Zwift, actually. It puts these stupid challenges. And I worked out Mountain Madness was, it was 7 o'clock on a Saturday morning, GMT. Mm-hmm. And I worked out that was the quickest way of me getting to it. it was led by a few regulars, but mostly Jonathan Geddes and George Parker Fuller. And I just sort of really got into it, really, really into it. And it's developed this kind of agenda, which we're going to loosely base this podcast on, which is we have a bit of a warm-up quiz. And then there's kind of on the run-up to the first, because it's always done on Alpe de Zwift, which is a recreation of Alpe d'Huez in France. And on the run-up to the first corner, we have kind of vent corner where everybody gets their week's vents out. And then you have a brag corner, and then a kind of the Ross and Regulars charity corner, philosophy corner, but also in between we have ice cream corner and talk about JG's love of hobnobs. But it's just really good fun, and there's this good community of people around it that you've joined in your training rides.
So we're going to try then to make this podcast roughly follow the structure of Mountain Madness. We're going to imagine that we are cycling up Alpe de Zwift, and we're going via various corners. Have you got a warm-up quiz for us?
Well, I think we've warmed up quite well, but we always play the birthday cake quiz. I should maybe think about one that we can slice in later. But yeah, I think we've warmed up enough.
Okay.
So should we get into it?
Let's get into it. So the first corner that we always get to then on Mountain Madness is Vent Corner. Have you got anything to vent about this morning?
Well, it's not really a vent, I suppose, but we before we did this, like, and it's sort of, what time is it now? It's 10:39, so an hour and 40 minutes ago, we were just setting off at the individual time trial in our club championships, and I had the pleasure of following you. I'd set myself a goal of not getting carried away and chasing people and sticking to my plan, which, as is usually the case, I largely abandoned within the first few pedal strokes. So that's my event. In the 807 races that I've done, plan went out of the window straight away again. What about you?
I don't think I have got a vent today. I think life is quite good. Maybe it's because where it's Christmas time and...
Yeah.
And there's actually lots to celebrate at the moment. I'm feeling I don't need to vent this week, but I'm sure I will do in future weeks.
Well, we've got lots of stuff to vent. Should we move on to Brag Corner?
Yeah, let's do
mine.
That.
I've got a much smaller brag than yours, so I'm going to do it. So okay. One of the things I did this month was race the World Masters Cyclocross Championship. So you are now have the pleasure of talking to the 63rd best 40-year-old cyclocrosser who could turn up on that day because of COVID. So I'm wearing that proudly today.
I think I'm going to have to tell everyone that I've met the 63rd best 40-year-old cyclist who bothered to not turn up because of COVID. I think they're going to be amazed to hear that. But genuinely, congratulations, because that's not something that I can claim. I'd love to be the 63rd best something in the world. I don't know that I'm the 63rd best something in the world at anything. So, big chapeau or kudos or ride on or whatever it is for that. Yeah.
So do you want to do yours now? Your much more exciting one.
Well, I suppose I've got a few things that I could brag about. I find Bragg Corner difficult, because I don't know if it's just a personality thing. I'd have this sort of built-in embarrassment about showing off. And when people compliment me on stuff, I don't know what to say. And so when I've done some, so in doing things like Everest the other day, and people are like, oh, that's amazing. Oh, yeah, that's such a brilliant achievement. I don't know what to say, because I'm like, why are you saying that to me? That's
I've just realised you've missed where the fetal idea came from. It came from listening to, I think it was Danny Kahneman talking about all of the, who's a famous economist, talking about all of the tables that he had to sit on at various events.
Okay.
And he said everybody introduced themselves in a really boring manner, which tends to be the name and what they do.
Sure.
And he basically said, the way that he started doing it is, right, you've got permission to show off.
Right.
Without any judgment.
Mm.
Because everybody's interesting, but they're not interesting if you just say who you are, where you live and what you do.
Sure.
So you've got, and that's where Bragg Corner was born.
Right. Okay.
Which is like, you've got unbridled permission to show off with no judgment. Because most of the time what people do is really interesting. Yeah. But as you say, if you hide it under a load of modesty,
sure,
it can't.
Yeah.
So you've now got permission. You've got unbridled permission to show off without judgment.
Well, that's kind. So the thing which I'm super proud of, as I've already mentioned from a few days ago, was virtual Everesting on Zwift, all day live stream, which was, I don't know, it was, I'm proud of it for different reasons. Firstly, there's the physical achievement, but more importantly, and we'll talk about this when we get to Charity Corner, more importantly was having raised just an amazing amount of money. I didn't expect that we were going to raise the amount of money that we did, and I was so overwhelmed, really, on Sunday by the whole experience.
Lovely. Have you got anything else to brag about? I've got one really minor thing, which is exciting, not really a brag.
I think that's all the bragging I can handle for one day. Let's hear your minor thing.
You know, I've got a really old Land Rover.
Yes.
I've discovered it's self-healing.
Okay.
So, the person who owned it before me, I think he had a lot of paint, and he's basically painted the whole for everything that you can see, with the possible exception of the steering wheel, green. And it's the only thing I dislike about it, but all of the paint is peeling off the bits that it shouldn't be on.
Okay.
So I'm delighted. So if I keep it for another 5 years, it will be perfect. So that's my brag. It looks, okay. It's myself. I'm the only owner of a self-healing Land Rover.
That's another thing to go on the CV next to 63rd best cyclocross racer in the world.
63rd best, the only self-healing Land Rover in the world.
Good. Where are we up to on the Alp?
So I think we're up to turn 14, which I think is Charity Corner.
It's Charity Corner, right, yes.
Charity Corner. So have you been doing anything for charity? I've been doing a little thing for charity, which I can talk about. Shall I do that first?
Yeah, start off with that.
So I discovered on Mountain Madness that there was this guy called Tim Burden, I don't know if you've heard of him, who was going to do a V Everest for MND.
Mm-hmm.
And now every year I do a longest shortest day, which is basically on the shortest day of the year, to kind of celebrate the shortest day of the year. Mm-hmm. We do a long silly ride dressed as festive for things.
Okay.
Usually on an inappropriate bike.
Yep.
And we ride all day, dawn till dusk, and usually raise a little bit of money. So I decided this year we'd do it to support MND. The only, which I could have put in Vent Corner, it got a bit kiboshed by COVID, because Vicky got COVID, which meant that I had to is the wrong word, but I was sole looker after of William. Mm-hmm. So I've dressed William up as a reindeer who's five. I'll post a picture, it's glorious. And we had a bit of a ride around, but still raised a bit of money for this, for Tim's ride. which was great, really.
Yeah, and I was so appreciative of you doing that. It was really lovely, and I think what I've realised doing this whole fundraiser for MNDA is that actually I really couldn't have done it on my own, and I absolutely couldn't have raised the amount of money that was raised on my own. Your shortest day ride was part of that. I've been trying to think about what are the things that made this successful, and one of the big things about it was community.
Yeah.
So again, just for anyone who's listened to this but doesn't know what we did. So it was virtual Everesting, 8.5 times up Alpe de Zwift, live streaming it all day on Twitch. Myself, virtual Everesting, and Carolyn Faltzgraf doing the same, and Ollie Wright also doing the same but doing more. So he did 10,000 meters of elevation. And the aim was to raise £1 for every metre of elevation. So £8,848 was the target. And that target came out of a conversation with my good friend David, who is living with motor neurone disease. I went to see him and because I wanted to check that he would be okay with me doing a fundraiser in solidarity with him. You don't want to just assume. And of course, I would be talking about him and his family. And so, I needed to make sure that he'd be all right with that. And he was absolutely fine with it. And as we were talking through and I explained about Everest, he said, "What's the height of Everest again?" And so I said, 8,848 metres. And he said, "Well, what about that as a target?" I didn't want to say, "No, that sounds ridiculous." But what I thought was, well, it doesn't hurt to aim high, because if you set a target that you know you can reach, if I set a target of 500 quid or £1,000 or something, yeah, then but I thought, well, all right, aim high, 8,848 quid, let's give it a try. Even if we raise 2,000 or 3,000, that's still a great amount of money. But with people coming on board and getting behind it, and with the momentum that built over the kind of 4 weeks, 6 weeks leading up to it, as of today, and including gift aid and including the money that you raised, it's over £11,000.
It's nuts.
It is. I can't quite believe it. People were so generous. Up until the day, so on Boxing Day morning, about £4,000 had come in, so we were almost at 50% before we started, which I was amazed by to start with. But we raised £5,000 on the day. I don't understand how people were so generous, and I'm just so appreciative of it. I mean, I think I just about managed to keep it together towards the end of
just
the
just about at the end, yeah.
Yeah. Because, of course, after sort of 12, 13 hours in the saddle, you're exhausted and emotional anyway. Mm. Put on top of that, the fact that you're doing it for a cause, which is such a emotive thing, plus people just being... generosity upon generosity. I'm actually quite surprised that I didn't just break down in a heap and weep about it, but somehow managed to keep it together.
As a person that joined for a few reps, I actually planned to do more, but I ended up only doing three. But my perspective, which might be useful for anybody else doing it, was that you made it very easy to donate.
Okay.
So when you say to people, "I'm going to cycle high at Mount Everest," unless you've done it, you don't really understand how much of a challenge that is.
Sure.
And I have tried and failed twice now. Once was a technical, but the second time I genuinely couldn't go any further. I got to lap 7.5 and I couldn't go any further. So it, that live stream made it really obvious what a challenge,
sure,
what a physical challenge it was.
Yeah.
That was thing number one. Thing number two.
Before you go on to thing number two, I want to just, for the benefit of people listening, that first time you used the word failed then. To start with, you succeeded in doing two amazing efforts at,
yeah,
Everest. And the first
not
time...
Not really a failure, you're right.
And the first time you had a power cut, didn't you? Just let's just, yes, get this clear. Within about 100 metres of the...
I think it was 500 metres. 500 metres of the total out of power cut.
And,
yeah.
And so, I mean, like, from my point of view, you completed that. I know you didn't get the badge, but
yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, yes, I just wanted to say it that was before we went any further.
Thank you. Yeah, that's very generous. But yeah, so but the point that I'm trying to make is it's really hard. You know, I've cycled pretty much every day for 8 years now.
Mm.
And it's a really, really difficult challenge, not just a physical one, but a mental one.
Yeah.
Because it sounds an obvious thing to say, but you go really slowly uphill.
Yeah.
So it's really taxing mentally to do it.
It's a couple of days now since Boxing Day and we completed the virtual Everesting. So I've been catching up with Carolyn to hear her thoughts and feelings about the event. So Carolyn, a couple of days on from Everest, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm feeling recovered, feeling you know, happy about what we accomplished, and
not too many aches and pains.
No, all good. Just a couple of days of taking it easy, and
yeah,
all back to normal now.
It was such an extraordinary day, really, in lots of ways. I don't know about you, but I found it so overwhelming in all sorts of respects. So it wasn't just the physical challenge, but the fundraising as well, but also the support that we had. What are the things that you think you'll remember about Boxing Day?
I mean, well, there are a lot of things, but I think one of the things that I was, I guess, pleasantly surprised about was just the support from the 3R team, honestly. I mean, we weren't even alone, even for a second. We had at least, I guess, 4 to 6 people with us for every single rep. And then at the beginning and the end, we had quite a few more. And it was just so great to have that team vibe, everybody on Discord. I think it was really motivating. And then I guess the other part that I really enjoyed was just seeing the donations roll in the whole time. It was so exciting that they just kept coming all day long. And then to see, you know, names, like familiar names popping up on the screen, the comments in the Twitch, it was pretty, I don't even think I felt tired at all until like the very end, just because of all that support we had the whole time. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, if you were to say to me, oh, you're going to do an all-day bike ride, 12 hours at least, with, you know, covering 200K and climbing 9,000 meters as it ended up being, you know that would be a day that would be really, really tough, that you would have low points, that you'd be exhausted. But somehow just the energy, the positivity just kept us going all day. And the breaks were really short, weren't they? We had 10-minute breaks at the end of each rep, and then we had 2 additional 20-minute breaks. Did you have any low points?
I had one rep. I think it was like number 5, maybe, where I had a lot of pain in my foot. You probably remember that. And I just kind of pushed through it and changed my shoes and changed my socks and all of that. And then I was able to get through the rest of them just fine. But I think it was really just that one bad one. And then the rest of them, I was just, carried on by all the support and positivity the whole way. And peanut butter and jelly sandwiches as well.
The timing was amazing. How Ollie hit his 10,000 meters, then we hit our Everest, and then we were
just within kind of grasping distance of the fundraising total. And so it was close enough, wasn't it, to say, right, we'll carry on going. If it had been like £2,000, I think we probably would have stopped. But because it was like, well, maybe. but because we were that close, it was something like 5% away from the target. It was close enough to keep that momentum going. And you know, by that point, loads more people were watching, so it just carried us through, didn't it? A couple of weeks before Christmas, before Boxing Day, when you were stuck inside with COVID in the USA, was there ever a moment when you thought this isn't going to happen?
I definitely had that thought cross my mind when I was in bed with like a 39 degree fever, shaking and all of that. But I just really hoped for the best, and luckily it was fine. I ended up having no real like lasting effects, but yeah, I did worry about it, to be fair.
And on the day, did you at any point think that you weren't going to be able to do it?
To be honest, no. I think that one of my strengths is probably like my mental strength. And if I just decide that I'm going to do something, it's going to happen. So I thought, I questioned how painful it would be to complete it because of the, you know, the fifth lap when my foot was really hurting. I hoped it wouldn't hurt that badly for all of it, but I never really doubted that I could at least finish it.
And of course, we should mention your motivation, my motivation for doing the thing in the first place. Your thoughts about that, about having raised so much for MNDA and...
Yeah, so, my motivation for doing it was my father-in-law. He had MND for, I guess, just under 2 years. And he went from being fully functioning to being able to do pretty much nothing in, I guess, about a year and a half. And I know that we needed like all kinds of stuff, machines to lift him, like a special bed, a stair lift, like all kinds of stuff. And we got a lot of support from MNDA to get that stuff. We also had carers that were coming in all the time to help out because it really is a full-time job.
How you've just described how David went from being someone who was able to do anything to being able to do virtually nothing. For us as people who are very active and for whom, you know, being able to be physically active is really important in life. It's scary, isn't it?
It's terrifying. Like I thought about that all the time when he was going through it. Like, oh my God, I can't even imagine what that would be like to have that as somebody who can't even go 10 minutes without, you know, getting up and moving around or doing exercise of some sort. And to be having to like rely on other people and put your trust in other people to just do basic stuff for you. Even just something simple. I think my husband said to me when he first learned about his dad getting diagnosed, there was something like try to sit still in a chair for 5 minutes or something, like really totally still and don't move. And, we tried it. It's like, it's absolutely impossible. You start to feel like, oh, I have an itch. I need to scratch it. Or I have whatever. You just kind of twitch, you adjust, you know, how you're sitting. And even those small things just to stay comfortable, like people, like my father-in-law, he couldn't even do that. I feel like that was kind of eye-opening as well. So he suffered a lot, and I think it's nothing compared to, or what we did on Sunday is nothing compared to, you know, what he had to go through. So it was good to keep him in mind.
Hey, Karen, thank you for talking to me again. And thank you again for volunteering to take on that crazy challenge.
No problem. It was really fun, and I would do it again.
I'll hold you to that.
Okay.
So when I started planning this, I thought, well, what can I do? And I've done a lot of long distance cycling. So, and people know that I've done a lot of long distance cycling. So if I were to say, oh, I'm going to cycle to, I'm going to do Land's End, John O'Groat, so I'm going to do sort of coast to coast to coast or yeah. something like that. People would be like, no, yeah, okay, he can do that, can't he? Yeah. We've seen him do that sort of thing before. And it would have raised a bit of money. I think if I'd done that, it might have raised about £1,000.
Yeah.
When I've heard of other people like yourself and others in 3R doing or attempting the virtual Everesting, I've thought to myself, I don't want to do that. Why are they doing that? That sounds rubbish. That sounds so horrible. Like, spending all that time on Zwift, going up the Alp over and over again, that sounds grim. So I'd said to people previously, I'm never going to do a virtual Everest. It sounds horrible. And so when the thought crossed my mind to do a fundraiser, this was the obvious thing to do. Because I didn't want to do it. It had to be hard. It had to be horrible. Not in a kind of masochistic way, but just because it had to be a genuine challenge.
The other thing that struck me about why you were doing it is that, and this really came through, you always read things in that you kind of believe in into things that you see, but the videos that you were posting in between, you were grateful. It struck me that you were grateful to have the opportunity to choose to do something that you didn't want to do.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Whereas the people who I don't know what the right word for it is, but who are diagnosed with MND, they don't have the opportunity to choose something that they don't want to do. You know, that circle of choices that they have over the way that they want to run their lives is slower and slower, smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's why you did it, but that's kind of what how I interpreted what you were doing.
I don't think I consciously did, but that's certainly a really interesting reflection. So, yeah, you'll remember in the video that I shared of my conversation with David, he spoke about agency and how the one of the most difficult things for him is having lost agency in this process. And that if people try to help him do the things that he can already do, then he gets very upset about it because they're taking away his agency. So he can't cut his food up, but he can eat his food if it has been cut up for him. So he doesn't want someone sticking a spoon in his mouth. You know, Carolyn spoke in her video about recognising that for her, stopping on a big endurance challenge was a choice. She had the choice to stop. But her father-in-law, also called David, didn't have the choice, and so so that was keeping her going. David's my friend David spoke about stoicism, and I find stoicism really interesting from a philosophical perspective. So we often tend to think of it, we sort of link stoicism with that idea of the stiff upper lip, don't we?
Yeah.
As the idea that, you know, you don't let things kind of bother you, which I think is quite a superficial understanding of it. So, but when you kind of pick into it a bit more as to what stoicism means as a philosophy, is that it's about saying to yourself, okay, these are the things that I can control. These are the things that I can't control. Why am I wasting my time and my energy worrying about the things that I can't control? They're just making me unhappy. I'm going to focus on the things that I can control. And actually, the things that I can control are probably very, very small. They might even, as some Stoics have suggested, there might even be pretty much either nothing, or they might be my own thoughts, my own feelings about the world around me. That's getting off track a little bit, but
I think it's exactly on track.
Yeah, I mean, to bring it back to MND, you know, as we said in the video for David, the sphere of things that he is able to control is rapidly shrinking, and therefore his sense of agency. This is, of course, is the same for anyone living with motor neurone disease. The sense of agency is diminishing. And we human beings like to feel like we are in control of stuff.
Mm.
And whether that sensation of feeling in control is real or whether it's just a perception, it sort of doesn't matter in this context. Yeah. But, you know, because for the person living with motor neurone disease, the experience of losing agency is very, very real.
Back in the 60s, a guy called Jack Bren had this idea about psychological reactance, and it was based on him observing when he was trying to do experiments. When he asked people to do something, they would react in such a way to do the opposite. And what it attempts to describe is exactly what you said. We humans have a need for autonomy.
Mm.
And when that feeling, and not even whether it's actually, but when you have a feeling that your autonomy is being encroached upon, you have an oppositional response to it.
Yeah, I'm sure there was a story a day or two ago about someone, maybe a teenager, who the more his mum wanted him to get the COVID vaccine,
yeah,
the more he refused.
Exactly.
And yeah. And just became entrenched in this position of knowing that it was the right thing to do, knowing that it was good for him and so on, but just wanted the choice, I suppose. Didn't want to be told. It. Yeah, yeah.
And I think back to Stoicism and back to MND and kind of for all of us, which is that I spent loads of time kind of an armchair philosopher, I suppose, and as part of my job and my background, I got really interested in choice architecture and how to make good choices and what it means to be happy.
Choice architecture is a great name. Can you unpick that a little bit?
Choice architecture. Yeah, yeah. But so basically, historical economics model is we're all rational beings, and we behave in such a way to maximise utility, which in other words is in any situation you try and get the most out of it, basically. And then came this field called behavioural economics, and which recognised something pretty simple, which is there's this thing called an economy, but there are people that behave in that economy, and they're all weird. They all do things you wouldn't expect. So there's this thing that's come out, and it's become a big thing in technology called choice architecture, which is where you can design things in such a way to make it easy for people to choose the right thing. And there's a few basic examples. Perhaps the most famous one is around pension enrolments.
Okay.
If you auto-enroll people on pensions, guess what people save for pensions? If you make them enroll on pension, people never save for pension.
Sure.
And the other thing is around choice. There are a few core things in choice architecture, which is more choice is the same as no choice. So if you've got a choice of 100 things, you never choose, which is why I thinned down my bike collection, because I'd stare at it and go, I don't know what to ride.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like choosing what to have at a restaurant, isn't it? It's much easier if there are just two choices. Yeah.
Because the other thing as well is, unless you actively choose, this is what I understand about Stoicism, by the way. It's not quite right. But unless you actively choose, you're going to be miserable.
Sure.
And there's loads of kind of studies on this, which we could get, I'm sure we'll get into in some future podcast. But that having a sense of agency and having a sense that you have an active choice about what you do seems to be really, really important to how happy we are.
Yeah. It reminds me, and again, we won't get into the whole sort of detail of whether choice is real or illusion today necessarily.
A but feeling of choice, yeah.
Yeah. But we went to, it was my birthday yesterday, and we went to watch the new Matrix film yesterday. One of the ideas, which of course was done to death in the earlier films and was done even more to death in this film, was the idea of, you know, choosing the blue pill or the red pill.
Yeah.
And the idea that actually you're not really making a choice. You're always going to pick one, the one that you picked. But again, without getting into to spoilers, that was a terrible movie. I was really, really, and yet at the same time, I enjoyed it. It was good fun.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was. I'd be interested in hearing other people's points of view. If you go to see it, or if anyone,
I'm going to go and see it. I'm definitely going to go. And
yeah.
See it.
I thought it was shockingly bad, but good fun at the same time. We always get to a point around about turn four on Mountain Madness, which I think is Philosophy Corner.
Yeah.
We've dipped into philosophy fairly fairly deeply here. We've been dipping our breadstick into the hummus pot of philosophy, then it's been fairly well covered. But it's the start of a new year.
Yep.
And New Year's resolutions, goals, ambitions, thinking about the year ahead. I think that's a good Philosophy Corner topic. Okay. What have you got planned?
So I've got two things. By the time you're listening to this, I'll have started a new job. So I've had a lovely 5 weeks off, kind of relaxing and thinking about things. So I'm not sure if this is an ambition, but it's probably a goal, is I've written down all the things that I know I'm not very good at, but don't really like admitting to. And I'm going to try and not repeat them. So as a for instance, I only like doing things that I think are worth doing, which is a strength. But when it comes down to I can't be bothered to do my expenses, it becomes a weakness.
Sure.
So I'm going to, that's one of the things that I'm going to do. But related to this is I'd like to be a better cyclist this year.
Okay.
Now, I have some specific goals around performing better in racing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also thinking about, well, what does being a better cyclist mean? Because I'm getting older, which means at some point I'm going to get slower.
Yeah.
So if I concentrate on, for instance, oh, I'm going to increase my FTP by 30 points this year, I'm going to end up miserable.
Sure.
So my biggest goal... an ambition, I suppose, is to enjoy the process of trying to perform better, but not getting disappointed when my performance doesn't match my ambition, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's a real catch-22, because if you don't have the ambition, you can't put the hard yards in to get it.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to walk that tightrope, which I guess is probably quite familiar for a lot of cyclists.
Yeah, I think that you and I are in a strange situation in that we, as we said earlier, we came to cycling relatively late in life, so in our 30s, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not late compared to a lot of people, but...
yeah.
And so I know that for me, having been very unfit, very overweight, I saw an awful lot of gains, successes all the time. So sort of year upon year, I mean, it's only been like, you know, 5 years or so, but...
yeah, me too.
But it's been like, wow, I've done that, I've done that. So I remember the first time I cycled 100 miles in a day, I allowed myself a little brag on Facebook for that. And people were like, wow, that's amazing. Doing, you know, increasingly long distances, competing in races, then more recently time trialing, this kind of thing. And... we're in a funny sort of situation because, as you just said, at some point, it's not going to be possible to keep improving power and that kind of thing. So success will look different, won't it?
So cyclocross is my thing. So that's what I'm going to target. And because so much of that is handling, and I reckon I can still get faster at it. But by the same token, I kind of know that it's a fool's errand.
Sure.
So I'm just going to try it. That's my aim, is I'm going to try and enjoy it. And I also want to do an Audax this year. So and I've almost booked one in, which I know is your thing. So I'll be asking you for some things. But I'm really looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to sampling the community and doing something which isn't necessarily about going fast, because most of the stuff that I do is about going fast.
Mm.
And I'm trying to do some things which kind of make me, I guess, look over the hedges, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Audax is interesting because it's not about winning, and there are no, times aren't published at the end of the event.
Yeah.
You get told when you get your card validated, it tells you what time you did it in, but no one is looking at each other's times because that's just not what it is.
No.
Which is fascinating. One of the things that I've really liked about time trialing, and I've done about 10, I think. What I've really liked about it is that while you are theoretically competing against other people, because, at the end, the results are there on the board and you see where you were in relation. It feels, at least, very much like an individual event.
Mm.
And I always say that I don't think I'm a competitive person, in the sense that I'm not fussed about beating other people. If someone's worked really hard and they've done better than me, like, well done them. That's brilliant. I'm pleased for them. I am competitive in terms of, I really want to see what I can do. Yeah. I spent the first 35 years of my life not doing exercise.
Yeah.
And I'm now in this weird situation where I can actually do things and do quite well at it. And I feel like I'm constantly surprising myself by doing quite well in a race. And that's why, like I said earlier, when people compliment me on stuff, I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
So for me, the aim for this year is to see what I can do on the time trial bike.
Love that.
I did one time trial at the end of July on my road bike. It was my club's time trial. Thought, this is brilliant. I'm going to get a time trial bike. And for the remainder of the season, it was only 6 weeks really, I thought, I'm just going to have fun with it. I'm not going to worry too much about trying to do the best time that I can do, because I didn't quite have all the kit. I didn't have brilliant wheels. I didn't have this or that. I thought, I'll just have fun with it, get a sense of what is possible and what isn't. And then 2022, then I'm going to really concentrate on trying to be the best time trialist that I can be. And so that's the exciting thing for me about 2022, is seeing what is going to happen.
How far you can go.
I don't know. Yeah, exactly.
And do you know, I love time trialing as well. And there are two things I love about it. I kind of love the, first time I went under 25 minutes, I thought, oh, it's exciting on a road bike. And then under 23, and then chasing faster and faster. But I love the sense that you've never got it right. That's the thing for me that I love about it. And I guess the reason why I like that is it always feels like there's more in. So this morning in Club Champs, I think I got my strategy spot on, but just not quite enough power. If that makes sense, because at the end, you should be dead, and I wasn't dead.
Yeah.
Well, they feel like good New Year's ambitions, really. Enjoy it, go faster, get a bit more involved. I've got one more to add, which is I have a tendency to be a bit of a, I don't know if cheapskate is the right word, but a bit of a cheapskate. It's because I'm not trying to be rich, by the way, but you don't get rich by throwing your money away. But I'm going to try and be much more generous. Because what I've discovered is it's lovely receiving something unexpected, but it's even more lovely giving something unexpected.
Sure. Yeah.
So I've done some things this year which actually have made me happier over Christmas than I thought was possible. One of them, for instance, is I started doing yoga to try and get faster at time trialing, which is brilliant, by the way. But the yoga instructor was giving away these labels for a local hospice that basically, not like a hospice, a place for vulnerable people to escape to. Can't think of the word for it. Anyway, and you basically had a kid... Refuge, there you go. They had a kid's name on the back and what they wanted for Christmas. And basically, that was their one chance to get this thing, because these people had escaped with nothing.
Yeah.
So I bought one home for all of us. And so I got it, and we gave... So on Christmas Day, they didn't know who I was. I don't know who they are. They've opened something. And that kind of made me feel better than anything that I could have got.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try and just do more little stuff like that this year to try and enjoy life a bit more.
Hey.
That's my other one.
Hey, I think we've got all the way through this, and I don't think we've had a single pun or a joke. Or so can you help us out with Can we make turn one at the top of the Alp? Can we make that
a joke, corner?
Joke corner?
I've actually just remembered a joke that my brother told me. Where do pirates go to get fit?
Gym lad.
Gym lad! I love that. It's sort of terrible.
So, Michael, this has been fun. I'm excited about future podcasts. Where can people find us online?
That's a great question. We'll put some links in the show notes, which is always the case. But if you Google Taylor Swift, don't Google Taylor Swift, you'll come up with the wrong things. The Taylor Swift Fan Club podcast, you'll come up with our glorious website. And you can find us on Spotify, wherever you get your normal podcasts, you can find us there. So I've enjoyed it too, and hopefully everyone else will enjoy listening to us too. But we're always grateful for some feedback. But yeah, look after yourself, and if you can, somebody else.
And you. See you later.
See you later.